now is a night's regular, Chief Economist with the New Zealand Initiative. And it's a very good evening to Eric Crampton. And welcome once again to the program, Eric.
Thanks for having me on. Great to have a chance to chat with you.
Absolutely. And I think tonight you want to talk about Wellington. I saw your piece in the Post in the headline, Rates for Change, how Wellington can be the blueprint for the rest of New Zealand. So what's going on in the capital?
Well, the capital is having a rates review going on now. So council is looking at the way that it sets rates and whether it might make a few changes to that. I think that there could be a fun opportunity in there for setting a much better base for Wellington going forward, for a stronger city, and potentially an example for others. I don't know whether the politics will let us get there or not, but it feels like the kind of thing where you could get some reasonable action. So just for a bit of background, rates are apportioned across different ratepayers. So the council decides how much money they want to spend on fixing pipes or whatever else, and then they split it up across everybody in town based on their proportion of the overall capital value of all the properties in town. And Wellington's always had this weird oddity where, or at least recently, ever since I've been in New Zealand, that the business differential is a lot higher in Wellington. So if you've got an apartment tower that's sitting next door to a commercial office block, and they both impose the same kind of burden on council water services and everything else, the apartment tower is going to pay a lot less in rates than the commercial tower. The commercial tower will pay 3.7 times as much in rates. So the councillors sort of on the left have been arguing for a shift from rating or apportioning rates based on capital value. So it's the value of the land plus all the buildings on top of it, to apportioning it only on land value, which would encourage people to put more capital on top of land, because generally you want to not tax as much the things that you want more of. And in general, council wants there to be more buildings and more housing, and especially more apartments and townhouses downtown. Councillors on the right have been a little bit nervous about this and worried that it's just part of some... the right in general worries that council's trying to drive people into particular ways of living. They've got their own vision of what the good life is, and they want to force everybody into an apartment and also try and put more on wealthier cohorts. A combination of shifting to land value apportionment and getting rid of the business rating differential could kind of scratch both itches at the same time. You'd have something for the left side of council that you'd get rid of one of the barriers potentially to upzoning and getting more townhouses and apartments up, because there'd be more incentive to do that. But at the same time, you'd have something for the right in getting rid of one of the inhibitions for businesses to set up in Wellington, because they're paying an awful lot more than their fair share in rates.
What difference would it make to the take from the council, the rates take? Would it be roughly the same, or would it increase?
Well, that's the neat thing about how rates get apportioned. No matter how they apportion them, council should get the same amount of money, because, again, they decide first how much money they want to spend, and then everything in rates apportionment is just how they divide up the pie. Right. So who's going to be paying what share of the bill? So the bill at the restaurant has already been set, and all you're really arguing about is who's going to be bearing what part of it. And ideally, if you set this up right, then you're not discouraging people from putting up more apartments, more townhouses, adding more capital land, not discouraging businesses from setting up. But it sort of links into sort of some of the broader themes that we're starting to hit in with housing and the election campaign, where housing maintaining a pretty strong focus, and it should. Yes. There's been reasonable consensus between National and Labour on the need to have more housing. They had reasonable consensus on the need to allow councils to encourage councils to have a lot more density, to allow more development. But unfortunately, over the past few years, there's been an implicit part of what it seemed the deal has kind of broken, where when Labour was elected, Phil Twyford made a lot of excellent points about the need for councils to grow both up and out. So on the left, there's been a lot of emphasis on cities being allowed to grow up, getting a lot more townhouses, it's more eco-friendly, more apartments, all that sort of thing. On the right, there's been concern of, well, if you're not allowing suburbs, then you're forcing people into living in ways that they might not want to. If they prefer to live in a suburban development, why not let them do that, so long as they're covering their own costs? And that had been kind of Labour's pitch when they came in 2017. Unfortunately, some of the policies that came in since then have made it a lot easier to encourage building up, which is great, but they've made it a lot harder for cities to grow out. And that isn't just a problem in maintaining consensus for allowing cities to grow up, because that seems to be part of the deal initially. It's also a problem for if you want housing affordability more generally, because land downtown ultimately competes with land at the city's fringes for people and for businesses. Mm. So if it's really hard to set up new subdivisions at the edge of town, then it's really easy for land prices downtown to become unanchored, that they get bid up and there's no competitive pressure at the city's fringes. So a couple of policies have been worrying on that front. But again, we see opportunity for there to be back to consensus. I'll come back to that.
Yeah.
In the past couple of years, we've had the National Policy Statement on highly productive land, which blocks development on land that's in the three most productive categories. So land use categories 1, 2, and 3. 1 would be the sort of potato land and the really important horticultural land. 3 is mainly dairy paddocks. That might not matter for some places, but cities like Hamilton are entirely fenced in by those 3 land categories. So it's impossible for them to grow out if they take those constraints to be binding. There's kind of wiggle room in the way that the National Policy Statement is written, but it's hard. It's still hard to build housing on it. In Auckland, the proposed future development strategy says there'll be no building going out. They're getting rid of private plan changes that would allow new subdivisions to come in when a developer wants a plan change to allow more building. And one of the reasons they've cited is highly productive soils constraint. Well, there's that, but that's also there are some of the slightly less valuable areas.
Yes.
There's some neat work that the Infrastructure Commission had done on this. Productivity Commission had previously done work looking at land value rates. So I apologize for getting confused there. They had supported a shift from capital valuation to land valuation. But back on the Infrastructure Commission, they'd shown that a square meter of land that is just outside of the urban zone in Auckland costs $1,270 more. One that's zoned is $1,270 more than the one that isn't zoned. So rural zoned land is a lot cheaper than urban zoned land. And that's after accounting for the cost of turning rural land into housing. So the land works and earthworks and all the stuff that you need to turn a paddock into residences. The Infrastructure Commission figured that was adding about $600,000 over $600,000 to the cost of a 500 square meter section. So what that means is downtown land that has to compete with potential new subdivisions, well, it's adding that cost all the way up through the whole city, that even apartments become a lot more expensive because we've made it so hard to build on city fringes. So if we get back to sort of the breaking of the consensus around the medium density rules, again, National and Labour had jointly agreed to these when they'd first come in. Nicola Willis had jointly announced them, along with Chris Bishop and the Labour Party. And they'd all supported requiring cities to enable a lot more building with less red tape, that you could put up to 3 houses of up to 3 stories on a site without too much rigmarole.
Yeah.
That consensus broke a bit with the inability to get more development on city fringes. Nationals put up an alternative policy that would require councils to put up 30 years worth of land development all at once, which sounds great, but it could still have room for councils to weasel out of it. That they could say, well, presumably they'll have some policing checks on this, but it's easy to imagine councils taking the piss. So proposing a mile high apartment tower that could house 1 million people and call it job done, right? That'd be one of the grosser ways. Presumably that'd get knocked back and National would say, well, no, you're being silly and we're going to put an urban development authority in over the top of you. But there'll still be all kinds of ways that they can play games with it.
Mm.
What I wish that we could get towards, though, if we wanted affordable housing, there's some kind of price triggers in these where instead of just saying that you're not allowed to build on agricultural land and particularly dairy paddocks, if we'd said, well, councils have to weigh up a lot of competing objectives. And these are written into the National Policy Statement on highly productive land.
Mm.
Councils are supposed, if they want to use agricultural land, they're supposed to demonstrate that they've taken all practicable measures to try and avoid using agricultural land. But to me, if a square meter of urban zone land costs $1,270 more than the adjacent square meter of rural zone land after accounting for all of the development costs, that seems like really strong evidence that council hasn't done everything that it can to enable enough development within town. Because if they had, then you wouldn't have that giant price differential right at the edge.
Yeah.
So you could start using price triggers as a way of getting councils to zone more land at the city's fringes when it has proven necessary. That is one of the parts that I would have really liked to have seen in Nashville's policy, that it would have depended on price triggers rather than giving councils a bit of more leeway than they really should need.
Mm. So where do you think we're at now?
Well, we're still in a better spot than a lot of places. There still is reasonable consensus that the ultimate cause of housing affordability issues is inadequate supply. People will argue about the extent that demand matters and on immigration. But if you've got a flexible land supply system, then those don't really matter nearly as much because you're just able to get more infrastructure out and more building happening in response to demand in the same way that we don't run out of barber shops or car dealerships or anything else when you have more migrants coming in, because we just seem able to supply those.
Yes.
We do seem to run out of housing because councils don't zone enough for it. Right. And that gets into issues around infrastructure funding and financing, as well as council incentives.
I have a listener's texted in. Please ask your guest what he thinks about value uplift rates.
Well, that's a neat idea. If you do it right, they can be a really nice addition. So,
can you explain what they are?
About to do so. Another word for them is betterment levies, and they're a part of New Zealand's history. So a lot of council infrastructure used to get funded in this kind of a way, where there are bad ways of doing this and good ways of doing this. Let's think back to how some of this used to get done in New Zealand. So if you look back to the 1913 Local Bodies Loans Act, and then the 1926 Local Body, is a different act that came in 1926 that put a bit of central government oversight on it. Infrastructure could get put out that was supported by debt if it was supported by a referendum of the affected ratepayers who could levy themselves over time to pay for the kit. And one way of doing that would be through a betterment levy. So if a piece of public work goes in that improves the value of your property by more than its cost, you should want that to happen and be prepared to pay towards it because it's making you better off, right? So you could imagine it in an urban setting where a new pipe going through means that you can upzone your property, put in a set of townhouses, own one nice new townhouse rather than one kind of dilapidated standalone house, sell off the other two, make some money, put the difference into the infrastructure that allows it to happen. In a rural setting, you could imagine it around landworks, dikes and weirs and flood protection works, where no one farm would be able to put those works in. But if neighbors band together for it, they could improve the value of all of their properties simultaneously, so long as they're all willing to chip in to fund it over time. And betterment levies or value uplift charges are a way of doing that. The really critical thing in this older legislation is that it was done with the consent of the affected ratepayers. And that's just the beautiful part that we've lost.
Yeah.
So now councils issue large amounts of general purpose debt, and it gets put into things like big convention centers or library do-ups that cost $100 million more in Wellington than they really ought to have. Mm. This kind of debt, it required the authorization of the people who would be paying it off over time. And that's a really good test for making sure that the project makes sense rather than being a boondoggle that's being imposed on people. I wish we could get back to that kind of a mechanism.
Yeah. Well, Eric, great to chat with you. And thank you so much for your wisdom. And we'll do it again. Thank you so much.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Chief Economist with the New Zealand Initiative there. That is Eric Crampton.